Today, Rohit Kalapur and Sina Sojudi of VMware, formerly Pivotal, join me to talk about the work they've done helping retailers migrate to event streaming and event-driven microservices. We talk all about Kafka and the Spring Framework on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am, as always, your host, Tim Berglund, and I'm joined in the studio today by two guests, Sina Sojudi and Rohit Kalapur. Sina and Rohit, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tim, for having us.
Now, as I always do, I'm going to ask you two to introduce yourselves, but I'll give everybody just a quick preview. You are both with the company that I am still habituated to call Pivotal. But we all know is now called VMware Pivotal Labs. Is that correct?
Yes, that is our name now.
Excellent. And you two are focused on helping people adopt Pivotal technologies, Spring Framework things, microservice refactoring, and event streaming, all those things that are of primary interest on this program. You actually do them for people. So I'll just start you guys off. Rohit, why don't you tell us about what you do and just a very brief account of how you got there. What did you do before you do what you're doing right now?
Your mysterious past.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. My name is Rohit Kalapur. I am a solution architect at the VMware Pivotal Labs. And what that means is we help customers migrate applications to the cloud. Both container platforms and platforms as a and PaaS platforms. Over the last 4 or 5 years, basically, my group has taken customers on this journey to the cloud, and that entails replatforming applications, breaking them down into microservices, delivering the outcomes that they need for their specific applications on the cloud. So hands-on, work with them, pair with them to get to their cloud outcomes.
And Sina.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Sina Sojudi. I am one of the global CTOs for VMware Tanzu, which is a portfolio of products and services for delivering modern applications to the cloud. I fundamentally try to be helpful both internal to the VMware business unit and also to our strategic customers, helping them understand the trends that are happening with modern ways of building applications, and also helping our internal teams build the products and services that cater to those use cases. Before this, I actually have been part of the VMware Pivotal family for over 10 years now. I was at a company called Extreme Labs that was acquired by Pivotal, with a focus on sort of mobile computing and the front end and the back ends of software that sort of gave rise to mobile in our lives. And long before that, I was actually a hardware engineer at NVIDIA and ATI and a few other companies.
Very cool. That doesn't come up on the program a lot. So out of naked curiosity, what kind of hardware?
This would have been, different depending on the organization, but the one that I mentioned was graphics card. Long before they were the engine behind AI, they were
fun games. yeah, and let's not forget that they still are, right?
People often forget.
Super cool part of your background. I've got a little bit of digital design in my background as well, so it's just personal curiosity. And now, Streaming Audio audience, you got to hear about it too. So, well, thanks you two, and I am excited to have you here because you're people who build stuff and you're accountable for helping businesses get results and do it in what I think is a product stack that is a pretty developer-friendly one. When you look at, I think for historical shorthand, I'm going to keep saying Pivotal just for the duration of the show. Right after this show, I commit to stopping that, but it'll just make sense. Just for today. But if you look at the Pivotal stuff, this is usually this is a set of technologies that are typically not imposed top down. on developers, right? There's usually a fair amount of grassroots enthusiasm. Like, a lot of them are things I would want to use if I were sitting down to build something, which I think makes the technical discussion that I'd like to have a little bit more interesting. You guys work a lot with retail customers. That's been a focus of the practice that you work in. So I'm curious, and I'm going to assume, correct me if I'm wrong, that essentially what you do is you help people migrate monoliths into container-based microservices. That's sort of like the template of application modernization for this generation. So number one, correct me if I'm wrong with that. But number two, assuming I'm right, what's interesting about retail? Like, what are the problems that come up with retail customers in trying to do that same thing that everybody all over the world is doing? Oh, and since there's two of you, you have to jump for the ball. I'm not going to call on you.
I'm going to kick start this because I've actually been in touch with the leaders of these businesses. And one thing I would say is that there's quite a number of applications that are you know, in the realm of what we do. There's quite a bit of retail that's not necessarily even visible, directly to the users. From supply chain to the whole operation of retail is actually fairly complex. But what's really interesting, even more interesting, since February, end of February, March of this year, due to the events that have been happening with COVID, is that the worlds of retail that have been established both in physical domain and digital domain are colliding. E-commerce has been part of us for a good decade or more. Becoming mainstream, even more mainstream now, and physical retail obviously has existed, long before I was born. What's new is that these two domains are coming very close together, and there's an intermingle of that. Things like buy online and pick up at store were sort of strategic initiatives for a lot of the retailers that we speak of, and this was somewhat new in the past few years. But now it's almost a necessity of life, when retailers don't have a good handle on it, it actually affects people's lives very much directly, and we're fairly sensible to the impact that these technologies are making today. So I think the most interesting probably about it is how companies kind of bridge the gap of technologies between these two domains. One particular use case being real-time inventory, having an idea of what you actually have. Is becoming a very critical information for the retailer, but also for the consumers of their products.
Right. So buy online and curbside pickup, which is, like you said, in the past 6 to 8 weeks, become a part of life for most of us. That's enabled specifically by real-time inventory. So you feel like you can draw a line between really the pandemic response of the business and the kinds of application modernization, which, that's the fancy way of saying we turned the monolith into microservices that you guys are all about. Is that fair?
Right. It's not just a differentiator and a business, strategic capability. This is like almost fact of life. You have to have it. Otherwise, your customers may not be able to use it. Right. And, you have to be obviously a normal consumer can still walk in their room, but depending on your situation with COVID-19, you may not be able to go into a store. There's groups of people who have to isolate themselves. So this is all of a sudden, becomes survival of our society dependent type of technology.
Right.
Yeah. And like all these retailers are also experiencing, they're going from their batch-based processes or their ETL-based processes to more streaming real-time systems. So they were anyway undergoing that arc of change. However, this pandemic has kind of accelerated that dramatically. Their volumes have also gone up by at least 100%, 200%. So they have this dual, they were on this arc of modernization from batch and ETL to more real-time streaming. And now the pandemic has kind of doubled, tripled their load because consumer staples have become huge in this time. And so they are now facing a two headwinds right at the moment, at this point in time. It's a challenging time for them.
And you mean online volume has doubled?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that makes sense. Can you help me out on a technical level? I like the description so far that you've given, but what are things you've actually done that make real-time inventory possible? What didn't work in the monolithic past that does now in the microservice event-driven present? And again, correct me if I'm framing the technology transition incorrectly there, but what was hard that you have made easy?
There are a couple of things just on that real-time inventory use case. The batch one has its own sort of challenges and what's happening now. But on real-time inventory, I think Rohit may have actually said this, that sometime years ago during a Black Friday, retailers realized that their sort of three-layer architecture on a relational database is just not scaling, and they sort of adopted a number of technologies to solve for that, distributing the database, going to a NoSQL form versus relational. And now, one of the consequences of that is that, yes, they're available, but on a technical form, it's hard to keep sort of this data consistent. And the usage of these NoSQL databases for, things like descriptions or e-commerce, typical site information may not be as critical to this consistency, but something like real-time inventory is extremely important for you to get that consistent. The technical term for it being, avoiding dirty reads, where you have multiple, in parallel processes are updating the count, for lack of a better word, and each of them has a different start. And as they're updating, they're essentially overwriting each other. So one problem is just, solving for that. How do you have a distributed, eventually consistent database become consistent? And this is, one place that Kafka and Kafka Streams can help a lot. The other one is again, kind of expanding that domain, is when you have now multiple systems, whether it's microservices or just a bunch of legacy systems that form the supply chain and the serving layer, updating data in each of these sort of systems of record is a real challenge. And the API, the HTTP API of scatter gather doing a request, update all these systems and, hope for the best, is just not really working. So we have customers in retail that are experiencing that, updating data between a finance system, legacy finance system, and a real-time inventory system all at the same time, is causing, again, either data, corruption in a sense, or just, a lot of these things fail, because once you start branching out into multiple systems, the call graph, kind of necessitates that, as shown by Netflix. And again, that's where, the Kafka's push model of updating state as events coming in becomes superior than updating at query, at user query time.
Drill down into that, if you would. I know where you're going, but I want to make sure everybody does. So it sounds like the foil, the thing that you come in and see at your next retail customer that you're trying to coach into the future. It's not a mainframe. It's probably a collection of, circa 2005 to 2010, even early Spring-based monoliths with an Oracle database behind them or something like that. Is that about right?
So that architecture has actually been updated. It's been updated to sort of have the legacy components that might actually be, still are backed by a relational database. But what's been introduced is, now you bring in, a NoSQL database like Cassandra or MongoDB or whatnot, depending on the use case. And now, you've kind of injected that into the whole system as well. And while the traditional architecture said, given the volumes and given everything was running in Oracle, you could have a transaction boundary that updated, all these different, states and whatnot through either a ESP or just through the database itself. Now you actually have a significantly more heterogeneous system, and that sort of distributed transaction doesn't quite work. So I think that we're kind of in a middle ground where people were upgrading their architecture into, you know, using tools that are new to deal with that high availability and disaster recovery better at scale. But it didn't quite arrive at a point where it's also resilient and consistent. So we're kind of just stepping through in a sense correcting some of that architectural choices to make sure that the system still is reliably providing the information that it needs to.
Yeah, I think, Tim, when we are brought in, usually the retail customer has a specific pain point, right? Like they generally have, like, for instance, issues with their real-time inventory not being updated correctly, or inventory at the store and the back system inventory being out of consistent, being inconsistent. They are typically losing money because of inconsistent inventory numbers in at the store and at the back office. So they either have too much of something or too less of something. So when there is a real pain associated with it, that's when typically we get involved and start assisting the customer figuring out how to solve those race conditions at peak volume, right? At like 10,000 item updates a second. That's where Kafka helps, right? It helps you design an event-driven streaming architecture that enforces serializable consistency on item updates. And so that's how, like, the Kafka plays a role in solving the customer's pain, the retail customer's pain point here.
Nice. So what you would have had, so I guess my framing of the foil was a generation behind you. The folks you come in and engage with are fairly up to date, really just one generation back and looking to jump forward to event streaming. So what you've got is, like, they knew they had database scalability problems, so they went to some horizontally scalable database, and they still had many distributed actors contending for that database, just to simplify things. And so you have consistency problems. You don't know what your inventory is. You're losing money. Walk us through. So for the benefit of anyone listening who hasn't thought through the problem yet, walk us through the transition from the, here are several services trying to write to Cassandra versus here are several services that use Kafka as a distributed log to enforce consistency on those writes. So maybe as specific as you can be with an example that, of course, isn't anybody's particular business, but just the general form. Migrate that for me. Give me the whiteboard without the whiteboard.
Yeah. This is going to be interesting. You know, right. One thing I want to say is that the problem has actually gotten more complex, because if this was just a single relational database and a single Spring app, it actually would have been a lot easier, because you have a system that sort of works. And the transition isn't that they did things incorrectly. It's they solved for a different problem. Their problem was scale and high availability. And along the way, they had to make some sacrifices on consistency. And it turns out that, you know, with real-time inventory, you really can't sacrifice consistency, because that number drifting makes it, in a sense, somewhat useless. If you're off, you know, zero, I have zero of this item available in the store for you to pick up versus I have, you know, five are very consequential in the users, in a consumer's behavior of coming to the store.
Putting it mildly.
Right. So, what typically, you know, goes through, getting back to your question of what is it, what is the challenge of getting there is fundamentally that this consistency has been sacrificed. There are some attempts at bringing that consistency back by saying, you know, we'll have, you know, for example, on Cassandra, we'll have lightweight transactions or different techniques that start to, again, eat at that availability. So they can't, in a sense, sacrifice either. They have to figure out a way that scales the system and makes it available, but also, reach that consistency level. So what typically they do is, the first step is separating, in a sense, reads and writes. What these folks don't want to do is, you know, yank out, you know, the underlying database and say all these, you know, applications that were depending on that API and interface are now orphaned, and we're going to create something net new. So by separating the reads and writes, one thing that's easy to do is, you know, you define the data model based on the reads, based on what the query time will be, and that remains consistent. then the applications that really just need to query the database remain as they are. And your writes now, you know, you streamline them through Kafka, as Rohit said. You keep a consistent state within the Kafka Streams applications, the count in this case, and you try to make that as minimal as possible due to operational reasons. And you know, whoever is trying to update that count has to go through Kafka, because the Kafka Streams app and its internal state essentially become that, you know, for the duration of the operation, the update operation, that becomes sort of the source of truth. But you don't necessarily expose that internal state out. You actually end up writing that to the downstream database, be it Cassandra, and you let, you know, the consumers of that reach that. And then this is true eventual consistency. You might be off by milliseconds to a second in terms of a data update going through your system, which is, you know, part, you know, from an internet perspective, that's fine. But the number will be correct. It's not, you know, there's no dirty reads, because everything is ultimately being funneled into that Kafka Streams application. What's known as single writer principle is being applied through Kafka.
And that single writer principle is key to the consistency guarantee that the system makes.
Precisely.
Right. You mentioned Kafka Streams. Rohit, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I could draw that, you said you wanted the whiteboard picture, right? So imagine this, like most, in most retail enterprises, you have this ingest of inventory item updates for inventory coming in, right? It is typically coming in through some messaging backbone like IBM MQ. And then that MQ update is being processed and written to some backend database. Typically, there is an ESB involved, which basically acts as a central router or hub for all the ingestion of all the item updates. And then some transformation occurs and then writes to a database. So your topology looks like MQ, ESB, and a database. Now, in the new way of doing things, what you do is you still accept all the item updates, item inventory updates through MQ, but you put Kafka in there to apply that serializability. And what that means at a lower level is that at Kafka, you basically leverage the power of K streams and K tables, right, to generate basically a summary event K stream that aggregates the inventory updates for a particular item. Say an item has been increased by 3, decreased by 3, or if it has been deleted, you aggregate that into a summary event K stream, and then you basically aggregate it and then you group by the store. And then you have an accurate inventory of that item in that particular store, and then you persist it to Cassandra using Kafka Connect. So you have gone from MQ ESB database to MQ Kafka, leveraging the power of Kafka, and not just like a mono. You have ingest and egress and a whole bunch and Kafka processes in between, using the power of K streams to group, aggregate, summarize, and then persist the data with Kafka Connect to Cassandra. So that's your target architecture and your and the source architecture that you started from.
And I want to not spend too much time on the basics of Kafka Streams. You guys have both mentioned Kafka Streams or K Streams. We'll link in the show notes to some episodes that cover that if you want to, if you're new to Kafka Streams and you want to dig into it a little bit. If you are new to Kafka Streams, strongly recommended that you dig into it a little bit. But given that, now that you've all hit pause and gone back and listened to those episodes, or you're already familiar with the basics, we can pick back up. And Rohit, I think what I heard you saying is that there are potentially many sources of inventory change that are coming in, and maybe those are independent topics, right? You're bringing those in as events that can mutate inventory. Yeah. And then you're combining those into a single topic or a single stream, mm-hmm. in Kafka Streams, and then aggregating them into a table. So you've got this, you know, pluses and minuses. A shipment came in, there was an online delivery, somebody came in and bought something, there was an inventory audit, and there was shrinkage, which is the retail euphemism for people stealing things. and so all those sources of mutations are all happening, and they all make it into this topic, and you aggregate them in a single K table in Kafka Streams, which is like the current state and the truth. Did I get that right?
Right. Yeah. Like there's like a balance on, like if you, like there's like a summary topic, and basically you use that summary topic and then there's a table associated with it that then you persist into whatever your long-term persistent store is.
Right. And you want, Sina, I think you said you deal with the readers and the writers separately, and you've got lots of readers which are expecting the contract of the legacy system to be upheld, which contract is, say, there's a Cassandra table they can query. Well, that's exactly. Fine. You've got a Kafka Streams K table. You can persist that to a topic. You can Kafka connect that topic into that Cassandra table, and all of those readers don't know anything. They think everything is normal.
They think everything just like magically got fixed. They're getting numbers that they should. I'll throw a curveball at this. You know, often you talk about real-time inventory and people are like, that's updating a number. How difficult is this problem? And you know, all the stuff that we talked about is one thing, but you know, one particular use case that sort of was, you know, a hair pulling moment for existing teams was what happens when that UPC starts to change, you know, randomly, because, you know, the manufacturer has decided to change it, you know, to change what actually appears on the shelf, because, you know, you have, you know, different packaging of it. There used to be four items in a pack and now there's like six items in a pack. And from a UPC perspective, that's the same item. So they have the same thing. But what actually shows up that you're scanning in the store is now different. And, you know, sometimes the retailer actually enforces that, you know, we were trying to, you know, the item that used to be on the shelves is now shown as a display, you know, at the front. You know, you have to change that, that whatever the scanner reads. And now it's almost like rug being pulled underneath you. You have these like very perfectly key value items, and now your keys are changing. And these are happening, you know, at you know, tens of thousands of items at once during the day. And what used to happen was, you know, you stop the world, you don't process essentially inventory until you go through a batch process of changing the keys in Cassandra. And this is where the power of streaming comes in, because now it's just an event, you know, an item has its key changed. It's interleaved in the order that it comes, and you know, everything remains the same. And, you know, this is where out of order processing starts to come in, that you make sure that by the time you're done with your processing, you know, that time of that event it remains consistent in your processing, and all the updates that were happening to an old key are now reflected into the new key. So this problem can get, you know, more and more sophisticated as you look deeper into it. But quite a bit of number of curveballs that can be thrown at a real-time inventory problem, even at its most basic level.
It can get, you said more and more sophisticated. I was thinking it can get more and more terrible, but you've got an underlying architecture that is prepared to deal with that kind of terror, which is really, really elegant. That's nice.
Yeah.
Because what an awful thing to have happen. And it's such a great example of why it's for me always fun to talk to people who are specialists in particular domains, because those are things that you don't think of until you've built the system. In retail, you know, yeah, UPC codes, you thought they were universal. They're not. And you have to deal with that, but you got an answer.
Yeah.
How about various parts of the Spring framework, Spring Boot? Where do those typically fit into your life here? I mean, I'm obviously nobody's going to engage with you if they're not also invested in that stack, I assume. So talk to us about where those fit in and the Kafka integration, the Kafka Streams integration, if you guys have anything to say. I'd just love to hear about that.
Yeah, I can take a first stab at that. So basically what we do is when we start a new system like this, we use Spring Boot as our core microservices framework. So Spring Boot, I won't get into a lot of it, but it's basically an opinionated way of writing modern applications with the Spring framework. It has a lot of, it is kind of like Rails. It has pre-baked opinion around configuration and how systems are set up. Along with Spring Boot, we use another framework called Spring Cloud Streams. Spring Cloud Streams provides a streaming abstraction which is independent of the underlying messaging technology. So we use Spring Boot as a foundational framework, and then we use Spring Cloud Streams. And then Spring Cloud Streams has what is known as a Kafka binder. And so you can, Spring Cloud Streams defines the concept of input and output channels and processors, and those leverage those leverage the similar programming abstractions within Kafka. So we use Spring Cloud Streams quite a bit because then it becomes easier to write applications. Spring provides a lot of syntactic sugar around configuring input and output and processors, and you basically, the Kafka binder provides implementations of those channels and processors at the, so you are at the Spring API level, and you don't have to explicitly code straight to Kafka. But the power of the Kafka API is also strong. In some places, we had to go down and leverage Kafka Streams and KStreams APIs to do some operations around and to do certain operations. So it's a combination of Spring Cloud Streams and Spring Boot as the base framework. 70 to 80% of the time, you can just get away with that. Sometimes you have to dig one level deeper and use actual Kafka KStreams APIs, which is also just fine, to craft the complete solution. So that's the story of frameworks here.
That is the story of frameworks, which is that abstractions leak. And if you're a developer using a framework, you're probably doing the right thing, right? Like most frameworks exist for a reason. Certainly, most parts of the Spring framework, most Java developers agree those are good things. But the abstraction always leaks, and so you're responsible for knowing the system one layer underneath the layer you're using. So if you're using Spring Cloud Streams, that's great because the integration with the rest of Spring is going to be tighter, and it'll probably wrap some things and make some common tasks easier, as pretty much every Spring API does. But then something breaks down and you have to go a layer deeper. So you still have to be willing to get your hands dirty with some Kafka Streams code if you're in the Spring world, I think would be that would be my architectural takeaway from that.
Yeah, I think maybe really Kafka Streams and Spring don't really impede on each other. The role of Spring is really making Kafka Streams the library, or the role of Spring Cloud Stream in particular is making using Kafka Streams, you know, DSL and write up a lot easier. Instead of you doing the connections and you know the boilerplate code that you write, we can actually transform that into just a function that, you know, you inject KStream and KTable objects into, and then you just write your DSL as you would instead of all the you know, undifferentiated heavy lifting that you do. So Spring doesn't actually get in the way of, it's not a choice of, you know, it's not a higher abstraction on top of KStream. It's making KStream, you know, more usable to the developer without, you know, the common things that they typically need to do. That's, you know, no different in every application. It sort of sets it up correctly, sets up all the, you know, error handling and all the, you know, observability components of that, you know, injects it into the Spring Boot correctly. But really what the developer is left is, you know, start writing your DSL, start writing your KStream applications as you would without needing to worry about those side cross, you know, cutting components that you would otherwise have to write as boilerplate.
Right. That Spring Cloud Streams does the wiring for, as we like exactly. to say in Spring world. Cool. So another kind of Kafka ecosystem component comes to mind. I'm reminded of what my friend Michael Nygaard said in his book, Release It. There are no e-commerce websites. There are enterprise integration projects with HTML front ends, which I think is deeply, even sometimes painfully true. Where does Kafka Connect fit into your world? I guess, does it? And talk about that.
Yeah, Kafka Connect is huge because, you know, typically you have a number of consumers already who are reading data from particular databases, right, or backend systems. You can't just change the consumers of your system to now read off of Kafka, even though you would want them to. Maybe they should. And Kafka has a very awesome, that's the power where you can consume at your own pace. Any consumer can basically latch onto a topic and consume at its own pace. But in order for us to smoothly transition our systems, consumers cannot be impacted. And so existing backend system databases have to be updated by Kafka. And that's where Kafka Connect comes into the picture, where you can map data from a Kafka topic automatically to a Cassandra table or to a MySQL table and have Kafka do that for you through Kafka Connect. And then your consumers automatically get all the updated data. So it's a very powerful feature that allows you that interoperability. As you build the new system, like as you replace the airline engine, you can still keep the airplane flying at the same time. So I think I have in almost all my Kafka projects, we have used Kafka Streams. So we have used Kafka Connect in one form or the other, either at ingest or on the egress side where we write it to a permanent data store where consumers latch onto.
I have a bit of a, I agree with everything Rohit says. From my thinking, one thing that Kafka Connect has done, there's a lot of connectors out there. I mean, for forever, any integration technology that has come has had some sort of a connect framework. What's special about Connect, and I will draw a parallel, you know, when object relational mapping came, people said, you know, this is solving the impedance mismatch between the way, you know, data gets stored and the way, you know, business queries come into play, you know, with set theory and the way sort of programmers write their programs, right? There's a bit of a mismatch in an ORM that, or in relational data modeling that ORMs try to solve. To me, Kafka Connect does something similar in an analogy to the push model that Kafka ecosystem depends on versus the pull model, which is most databases, you know, in a request response fashion have you know, traditionally existed. It sort of forces that mismatch and brings that to light and, you know, helps obviously solve quite a number of challenges with that. But it makes the push model of actual streaming brings it to where that, you know, database or data source sits. I think the biggest value of it is really helping developers, you know, avoid, again, some of the heavy lifting themselves and also do it in a reliable way. To bring these typically static or request response type of data sources into a streaming paradigm.
How about after things are built? You know, we whiteboarded a little while ago. A lot of code got written and things are deployed, and now the business is relying on things. How about day two? In the few minutes that we have left, what are some day two operational issues that you've encountered, and how have those gone?
Yeah, so day two is very interesting because this is where, I mean, you absolutely need dashboards. So in our specific projects, once like the MVP solution is picked out, you basically have to throw and do scalability testing at the workload because a lot of these projects, it is critical to generate the right inventory numbers at a very high volume. So one of the things that we do is that we subject the system, the set of services that we have built using Kafka to a high amount of load. And then we start looking at various metrics, and a number of metrics are put out by Kafka itself. So it's a matter of visualizing those metrics, making sure that your partitions are evenly balanced on the Kafka topics, making use of I think Confluent also has its control center. Or you need a very systematic way of understanding how is your Kafka cluster doing under that sustained amount of load, right? So it is important to understand like the day two operations, like day two is as important as day one when it comes to volume and serializability. Because if you have to give considerations of in your topology, is your Kafka cluster active or active passive? How is this going to work when you have to also think about failure options and things like that? So we went through and thoughtfully broke down all the day two operations under what happens if a particular Kafka cluster goes down or if a portion of a cluster goes down, how will we survive? So it's important to do those kind of tests and experiments and subject your application to a realistic amount of load and visualize that, because in production, you will definitely see all those cases, and you need to be prepared. You need to be able to understand the state of your system by looking at logs and metrics and trace data.
Sina, as a global CTO, are you there on day two?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we're there, I think, for day two. The day one is always easy if you don't have the day two. But yeah, it's the day two that brings these technologies in place. You know, the day one is we don't want everybody just with a PhD to be able to apply these modern application principles and architectures. But the day two is that, you know, I feel confident that when, you know, Pivotal Labs moves off of this project, that I'm enabled enough to maintain and run this at scale. And I think that's the fundamental way that we think about it, is that what can we do that the existing organization can essentially run these architectures and these applications in production for years to come as critical part of their business.
My guests today have been Sina Sojudi and Rohit Kalapur. Sina and Rohit, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you, Tim, for having us.
Thanks, Tim.
And there you have it. I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at @TLBerglund on Twitter. That's @TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you want to register there. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.